And welcome to Perspectives. Perspectives is featuring the book club. And on Perspectives today, we have Angela Flournoy. Angela is the author of the novel The Turner House. She is a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop, where she received a Dean's Fellowship and the University of Southern California. She has taught writing at the University of Iowa and Trinity Washington University, and she has worked for the District of Columbia Public Library. She is raised in Southern California and by a mother from Los Angeles and a father from Detroit. And so we are very honored to have with us today Angela Flournoy. Angela, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, as I mentioned, this is your debut novel, and it's called The Turner House. Have you been working on this for a while? Did you have an idea, like, way back when? Or at what point did you start writing, Angela?
I started writing in April of 2010, so almost exactly 5 years ago. And I think I really only had the idea for about 10 months before that, maybe in September of 2009. I just had a sort of grain of an idea that I didn't really know what I was going to do with. I thought maybe it would just be a story. So it took a little bit of kind of gestation before I even started writing the book. And I finished last summer, so a four-year process.
Now, as far as writing goes, Angela, is this something that you did since you were a child? Did you enjoy writing? Did you enjoy reading, storytelling? I would imagine that working in one of the biggest libraries in the country, the District of Columbia Library, would be like a dream come true for a writer or a reader.
It was. The D.C. Public Library was great for me. I worked a schedule that allowed me to write, and I had all of, you know, access to all of these books at my fingertips, and they have a Black Studies department. They specialize that in their downtown branch, which was great for me just as far as like finding historical texts that could help me in my final sort of rounds of revision for my book. As far as my history with writing, and I've just have always been a lover of stories and been writing writing fiction before I even knew what it was since I was very young. The first sort of thing that I ever had published, if you can call it publishing, was in second grade. My elementary school put together like a little literary anthology, and I had a story in there. So it's always been something that has been a part of my life.
Now, as I mentioned in your bio, that you grew up in Los Angeles being brought up by your mom and your daddy in Detroit. The story involves, I believe, 19 children in the Turner House. So are you a single child, only child?
I am one of four. There's 13 in the book, but I am one of four. I'm the second out of four siblings.
So take us through the story as far as the 13 characters, because when someone writes a book, when somebody reads a book, actually, they expect every character to have a, you know, certain personality. They fall in love with the character or they can't stand the character. And so when you have to follow around 13, that's quite a number, although I think Cha-Cha is the main one, isn't he?
I would say that Cha-Cha is the main character. That's the eldest son. Him and the youngest daughter, the 13th child, Layla, they are sort of the focal points of the book. I wanted to write about what it feels like to be in a big family more than I wanted to write about, you know, just every single member of a big family. So I kind of wanted to communicate both the largeness, but also how it feels to be an individual part of something so big. So I decided very early on to focus on a few, to give the reader enough information to sort of understand the other siblings, but to really not try to make it everybody's story.
We're visiting with Angela Flournoy. Angela is the author of the novel The Turner House. In this novel, as you mentioned, 13 siblings, and Cha-Cha is the oldest. Did you write this with the feeling, because I think a lot of people who read this will say, yep, I know how Cha-Cha felt because I'm the oldest, or I was the oldest, and I always got lectured either on the good side or on the bad side from my parents?
I guess I just imagined I'm not the oldest.
Right.
So I put it away with, I think there's a way that the oldest is supposed to be, or sometimes it doesn't end up being the oldest. It's just the person who, for whatever reason, maybe personality is designated as that person. the preserver of family history, the rememberer of birthdays, the person who's, you know, sort of more concerned with family conservation and communication than others. And that may not always be the oldest. Sometimes it falls on gender lines, like it's the only girl, or, you know, on the other side, it's a boy who ends up being it. It just depends on sort of the culture of that specific family. But I have found I come from actually sort of four large families, my mother's and my father's and two adopted families that I grew up with. And in all of them, there is that one person who's supposed to be sort of the keeper, the one who keeps the family together in some way. And if that's even just hosting all the events at their house. So
in traditional large families, as you mentioned, there's usually a patriarch or a matriarch. And in your case, there was one available.
Yeah.
Now, you have a lot of reviews on this book, and they're all very good. And, you know, if some of them are bad, I think that's good, too, because you can feel like, well, I need to work on this or I don't. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, not everybody is going to like your book. However, you got the, if you want to call it the good stamp of good housekeeping stamp of approval, whatever, from Oprah and Oprah Magazine. She writes, Flournoy has written an epic that feels deeply personal. Flournoy's finely tuned empathy infuses her characters with a radiant humanity. And, you know, when you get blessed by her or she picks you as one of her books for the book club or in the magazine, that's good.
Yes, I was, you know, delighted when I found out about that, mostly because it's sort of a concrete bragging rights for my mother. So, that made me feel good. But also, I think that, you know, when you read reviews, I'm a person who haven't come to the place yet where I'm not reading reviews because they're still like a new and novel thing. I'm not necessarily reading every single one, you know, on the internet, but I certainly, when I saw that one in Oprah, I read it. You, even if it's, you just hope that it's fair and you hope that the person at least got what you were trying to do, even if it is in the sort of vein of, I get what you were trying to do, but I don't think you did it. That is still something I can respect more than, you know, somebody writes a review about something that wasn't your game. Like, you know, they criticize goals that weren't goals that you were trying to meet in your book in the first place. So I was just happy because, you know, empathy is very important to me and sort of coming from a place of emotional truth in my writing. So to see that included in the review was just, you know, really great for me.
We're visiting with Angela Flournoy. Angela is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. She received a Dean's Fellowship at the University of Southern California. She has taught writing at the University of Iowa and Trinity Washington University. And she was raised in Southern California by her mother from Los Angeles and father from Detroit. And as she mentioned, a blending of families, also adopted families. But I'm going to, if you don't mind, Angela, I'm going to read a little bit here from the jacket, the book's jacket. And this is the part where your dad is the dad, not your dad, but the dad in the Chacho's dad is talking. There ain't no haints in Detroit. So spoke Francis Turner, patriarch and provider, former preacher and current truck driver. When his children claimed to have seen a ghost, a rising homeowner set to banish all the old ways for the promise of the new, Francis was having none of it. He and his wife worked hard to secure that house, to move up from Arkansas to Detroit to make this life possible. He would not be haunted by the past. And so a myth was born where any one of the Turners might later repeat that phrase and be telling about so much more than haints. I think that passage there just grabs everything because, you know, Dad wants to say, hey, we left the past and that's behind us and we're moving forward. And I'm here, and so is your mother, to help you with anything like this and pass that on to the children. That's the way I interpret it. If you wouldn't mind letting us know what you thought about that, why you wrote that.
Yeah, I think that you're exactly right. There's a way in which this story is sort of a great migration story. It's, you know, part of that really 20, 30 years where hundreds of thousands of African Americans were migrating from the South to the North, some of them just for, you know, better wages and more opportunities for job growth, and others to escape the very real threats under Jim Crow. So more for this family. It is kind of the former that's it's supposed to be for economic progress and opportunity and growth and just to sort of make something of oneself. And so the father, without giving away too much, he does not want to be reminded sort of the life that he left behind. So the ghost in the story ends up being a manifestation of, you know, the ways that you can't just run away from your past.
Describe for us, Haint. I don't think I've ever heard a ghost or a spirit or whatever been referred to as a haint. Does that mean that it ain't there?
What's
in your mind?
Differing etymologies about the origin of the word haint. There is the idea that it's sort of like a portmanteau of haunt and ain't. Like, you know, a haint might, there's that etymology that it's like this idea, these combination of two things. Like it ain't alive and it ain't dead and it's combined with the words. But another one is just that it's just sort of a dialectical translation of the word haunt. But the stories, growing up, I heard stories from my grandparents about haints, and they were all set in the South. And it was really just like a ghost, like a lingering presence. And in my research, a lot of stories of haints sort of have to deal with the years right after the Civil War, which would make sense. You know, a lot of people died, and there were a lot of people who might be lost souls for whatever reasons. But I really wanted to call the ghost a haint instead of just using sort of a more modern term for it, because it also relates to this idea of the past sort of staying with you. And language is one of those ways that we have these like markers of the past. And in my life, hearing only, you know, people of a certain age refer to ghosts as haints was one of those sort of markers of the past still being present. And in my story, the ghost is specifically a vehicle for one character, Cha-Cha, to struggle with his beliefs and his sort of ideas about himself. He doesn't see himself as a man who believes in ghosts even, but he's had these experiences, and there's no other way to explain them besides he's seeing a haint, right? So he has to deal with that. What does that mean for him that he's seeing? He thinks of himself as very practical, not superstitious, but he's had these experiences that are, of, you know, to the contrary to the way that he'd like to present himself to the world.
We're visiting with Angela Flournoy. Angela is the author of the latest novel, The Turner House. And Angela was just explaining a little bit about the haunting or the ghost that some of the children in the house seem to see and hear and look. And the dad wants to let him know that there isn't such a thing, that they need to move forward, that that's in the past. And when Francis, the father, is talking about this, he's a very diverse man. You could almost say he's a Renaissance man. He's done a little bit of everything, from preaching to driving a truck, of course, being a father, and just a little bit of everything. And so he has done what he can to bring this family together, to provide this home, provide for this family. But at some point, of course, the mother plays a role, but she gets sick at one point.
Yes. By the time she's sick, Frances has passed away. Frances passes away in 1990 in the book. And so where we meet, the present-day narrative of the story is in 2008. So 28 years have passed since Frances has died, but he feels very present to a lot of the siblings for various reasons, mostly because he was an enigmatic man when he was alive. He was very loving and he supported them, but it was very hard to understand exactly what made him tick or why he maybe did some of the things, made some of the choices he made when he was alive. But Viola, their mother, has been a lot more of a constant figure. She, one character in the book compares her to the Queen of England, meaning she's sort of the figurehead, but she's not very concerned with the everyday governing of the family. She delegates that to her older son, Cha-Cha, and who is compared to kind of like the prime minister. So he does all of the everyday business and the work, but she's the symbol.
We're visiting with Angela Flournoy. Angela's novel is The Turner House. Angela, you mentioned that you started writing this, I think in 2002, is when you told us earlier in the interview. But I want to find out, coming from a small family, and it's not, well, four children is not a small family, but it's not huge, like 13 children, or, you know, people used to have children, a lot of children back then, especially if it was a blended family. What did you feel like you needed to do as far as research and to tie this together and make it into a nice little bow where everybody's involved and anybody who picks up this novel and reads it, they can relate to at least one of the characters in that book?
I think that research was really just life experience. Even though I only have four siblings, I've grown up around just a large network of families. So there's a different way that your brain sort of processes relationships when you, at a very young age, have so many names and relationships and connections to that you have to navigate. I think it makes you able to have moments sort of intimacy and like connection with a lot of people. Whereas if you come from a very sort of nuclear and small family, you may find those having, you feel overextended if you were put in a similar situation. So in my mind, I actually think I could have written about even more characters, but I thought that for the sake of the reader and for time and making the story feel not overwhelming, that I would have 13 but really focus on a few. And really, it's just I've always been fascinated with the various – every family has, like, its own culture. You know, there's mm-hmm. the way that people communicate within the family, expectations within the family – even just the way that they celebrate when they get together. So I've always been very like observant of the fact that all of the families that I grew up with are very different in that way. And I wanted to kind of create like a mashup family that has characteristics of all of the ones that I grew up with.
Now, in your book, The Turner House by Angela Flournoy, we're speaking with Angela about this novel. It's her debut novel. And some of the reviewers have commented that this marks a major contribution to the story of the American family, because the Turners, as the book is called, the Turner House, has been on Yarrow Street for more than 50 years. That house has seen 13 children gone, grown, and some return. It has seen the arrival of grandchildren, the fall of Detroit's East Side, and the loss of a father. And this is what I think is very important, Angela, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the house still stands despite abandoned lots, an embattled city, and the inevitable shift towards suburbs, because that shows how strong that house is, not as a structure, but from the people who live there, the patriarch and the matriarch and the children.
Certainly. I think it takes a certain amount of resilience for anybody, especially if in a challenging economic climate, to hold on to their houses. I think we all saw that in, you know, 2008 when we had the last housing bubble burst. But I wanted, that's part of the reason why I set the book in 2008, because even though this house and the situation in Detroit is different, I think it's a way that everyone else reading the book can recognize just what it felt like during that time when people were losing their homes, really just all over the country. And it is not a judgment against someone's character if they're not able to hold on to their home, but sort of a testament to this particular family, given the fact that the challenges that their neighborhood faced were a lot more longstanding than, you know, one housing crisis, but the house was still there.
One of the things that authors, as I mentioned it before the interview, we have interviewed many authors, from David Baldacci to Mary Higgins Clark, Sandra Brown, Nelson DeMille, and just about every one of them has said that the most important part of the novel or their writing is that first sentence, and that first sentence has to be ready to grab the reader, ready to grab your attention. And if it's not a good first sentence, the likelihood of people putting that book back or not picking it up for a while is very big. Would you agree?
I would agree. It's a lot of pressure, but I usually give a book a first page, but there are certainly readers who do not do that. So
what about, because we mentioned Kindles, ebooks, and audiobooks earlier, How have, for example, audiobooks, how have they helped you or not helped you? Because sometimes it may be a great story. However, if the narrator is not a good narrator, not reader, because anyone can read and the last thing that people want to hear is somebody reading to them. But audiobooks now have become dramatic dramatizations and everything comes to life. So tell us about your experience with audiobooks.
I was fortunate enough that I was able to have some say in who read my audiobook. I was given a few basically auditions where they read. They select sort of what they think is the best part of their book, the book to read. And I was saying a few MP3s that I was able to listen to. And I chose my my reader, the voice actress, her name is Adinrele Ojo. She's based out of Los Angeles because she sort of struck the right tone between contemporary but with sort of a classic storytelling style. I didn't want the story to feel too contemporary as far as, it's hard to explain, you know, just what about a voice makes the voice sound right. But for me, I think she struck the right balance. I'm very happy with it. I know that some people, I was just reading the latest New York Times Magazine profile of Toni Morrison, who I love. She reads all of her own audiobooks. I don't know if I like my voice that much. I don't have an amazing voice like her, though. So I could probably do it, but then I would never, ever, ever listen to it. Or maybe I just need to take some classes and maybe for the next book I can get better. But for now, I felt like I was in good hands with her.
Well, you know, a lot of us who are talking on the radio or do narration, we do not like our voices. And I think it's because we hear it and we're going like, ow, that's really awful. So sometimes I feel sorry for people who have to listen to me when I speak to them. Because I go, man, do I sound that bad? So I think we're our worst critics. You sound very good.
Thank you. You've got a good radio voice.
Well, thank you. One of the other issues that some authors have been bringing up as well is, okay, you started the novel. You're writing the novel. You've brought in some great characters. Now, how do you end it?
Oh, that's sort of the overarching challenge of writing a novel for me. Is I'm not an outliner. I try to be an outliner, but I never stick to those outlines. So I probably didn't write an outline after maybe the first few months of the book. I can outline individual characters, like where I want to send them, what points of tension I want them to kind of come up against. But it's very hard for me to figure out then, especially because this book, there were multiple POVs, how is everybody's storyline going to sort of come back together? And that is kind of the beauty and challenge of revision, is if you don't succeed the first time, you've just got to go back and sort of pull out some of those stitches and restitch them until things come together in a way that is satisfying to you.
We're visiting with Angela Flournoy. Angela is the author of the book, The Turner House. Angela, our listeners would probably want to know, what is Angela reading right now, or what does she read?
Right now, I just finished rereading for, I think, maybe the fourth time, a very old novel. I think it was published in 1950, by a writer named Paul Marshall. It's set in 1940s Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, and it's a coming-of-age story about like a young woman from whose parents are from Barbados. I was rereading that for an essay I was trying to work on, but it's just sort of a African-American writer that was, I think, maybe didn't get as much attention because she was not young enough, I mean, old enough to be part of Harlem Renaissance, but she sort of wasn't also part of the, like, 1960s, 70s, like, black arts movement. So she's in this space in the middle, but it's an amazing book. I just finished last weekend. I am looking forward to finishing Asali Solomon's latest book, Disgruntled, which is also a coming-of-age novel. It's set in, like, 1980s Philadelphia. So far, it's been great. I put it on hold because I wanted to reread this other book. I guess I'm reading a lot of coming-of-age novels right now.
Is that a sign of perhaps Angela Flournoy's next novel?
I don't know. I'm interested in sort of the Bildungsroman, that sort of book, and how it sort of timeless. You know, there are always people that want to read about sort of someone's path to self-actualization or realization. I never thought I was, I don't know, I just didn't think of myself as that sort of writer, but I have been reading a lot of those books. I don't know what that means. It may mean that I am just thinking about my childhood more. I'm turning this interview into like a therapy session, but it could mean that, or it could just mean that maybe one day I will write a coming-of-age novel.
Could you remind us again, what is the name of the book that you said you just reread?
The one that I reread is called Brown Girls, Brown Stones.
Brown Girls, Brown Stones?
Yes.
What about this book, I would think, is readable by just about anybody. Would you agree? I mean, is it something that the entire family can read, or is it only for adults, or you have to be at a certain age? Because young adults are being targeted heavily right now by a lot of authors, and it's no longer a juvenile book or teen books. They're young adult books, and a lot of them are coming-of-age books, and some of the books that were perhaps not intended to become coming-of-age books, like A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, The Boston Girl, a lot of Dickens, some of those stories are coming up because young adults are reading a lot more.
Yes, they are reading a lot more, and I think that's great. And I think a lot of adults are also just reading YA novels, which I think is an interesting phenomenon. There's people who are sort of very against it, but I think that there's a way in which a lot of books are maybe not marketed as YA, but are also sort of dealing with the same thing. Certainly a lot of coming-of-age novels. I think that now some of those books are just finally being marketed to this new and sort of lucrative genre. But we could argue that, as you mentioned, there were books that were not necessarily marketed because that just wasn't like the hot category at the time. But that would certainly still fit the mold of YA. I think that have I read any YA marketed for YA books? I've been meaning to. I have not read any of the sort of popular trilogy sort of books, but I have been. I've certainly watched the movies. I have a 15-year-old little sister, so I am well aware of the trends, and the movies are compelling. So I'm not opposed to them at all.
Angela, we're getting ready to wrap up here, but I was going to ask you, for the benefit of our listeners, if there is a particular web page that you prefer for them to go. Do you have a Facebook page in case there's something perhaps that we didn't touch upon more in detail and they want to find out more about you and your book? What is the website?
My website is my name, angelaflournoy.com.
And that is FLOURNOY.com. We've been visiting with Angela Flournoy. Angela is the author of the recent novel, The Turner House. And again, it's been getting some rave reviews, and you'll really enjoy it because it's a family story, and it's about 13 children growing up in this house, the Turner House. And so I don't want to give away the rest of the story, but we talked a little bit about that, and you heard what Angela had to say about that. But again, angelaflournoy.com is her webpage if you'd like to find out more about it. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Belinda Fernandez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Science.